Let's get started, Dimitri, with what's going on right now in Ukraine between Russia on one side and Ukraine and NATO on the other side. What's going on in the Kursk region, in your opinion?
Well, right now it's basically a mop-up operation. The Russian troops that were streaming into the border region, it's about 100 square kilometers along the border, maybe a little bit more. It's something like 15 kilometers deep and maybe 10 kilometers wide. The part that got infested with the Ukrainian marauders, they rolled in. They caused a lot of damage. They were shooting at civilians. They looted a lot of houses and then tried to drag all the loot back across the border. A lot of them got killed in the process. And now they've pretty much broken up into small groups of as few as two or three terrorists who are hiding out, and some of them are shooting at anything that moves. They've been shooting at ambulances. They've been shooting at the volunteers who are pulling out the remaining civilians. Most of the civilians have already left. Many thousands, but something like 100,000 civilians have been pulled out of that region, that border region. But now they're just basically getting killed. The efforts on the Ukrainian side to penetrate the border again are being stopped. Short of the border, basically the Russians are penetrating Ukrainian territory to some extent to make sure that there is no repeat of the invasion. And there's also no real impetus to take prisoners, because these are not prisoners of war, they're terrorists, because they invaded a peaceful region and they fired at civilians. They fired at ambulances, fire trucks, basically. They looted houses, and so this is not any kind of honorable military activity that falls under the Geneva Conventions or something like that. So if they sort of accidentally get shot while being apprehended by the Russians, so what? In any case, they're not going to be traded because they're terrorists. They're not going to be traded for Russian prisoners of war because they're not prisoners of war. They're terrorists. So the best that could happen to them is they'll stand trial in Russia as terrorists and go to prison for very long terms. And the funny thing about terrorists is that they don't live long in Russian jail. It's sort of mysterious how that happens. Nobody really knows why they die so quickly and easily, but none of them so far have actually lived the entire term of their sentence, which is 20 years, something like that. They're all dead. They all die. So in any case, all of these people who went on a rampage invading Russian territory, they'll be dead one way or another. And that's basically what's happening. Also, there are a lot of Polish people, a lot of French, some Americans, sort of mixed in among among these terrorists. And these are also terrorists, and the Russians are quite clear on the fact that, the fact that they're from NATO countries makes no difference at all. They'll be treated exactly the same. And the fact that they come equipped almost entirely with NATO weaponry and equipment is also not lost on Russians, because they understand who the terrorists are. NATO is the terrorist. And so that sort of colors the picture moving forward. As far as any sort of negotiations for ceasefire or any sort of peaceful settlement with the Ukrainians or whoever stands behind them, this little escapade has made that altogether impossible. And Putin, during a meeting yesterday with his cabinet, pretty much spelled that out, basically saying, who are these people that we would talk to them? Terrorists. And so that's basically end of story. The other thing that's happening is that the Russian advance along the actual front line that runs through Donetsk and region south of there and Kharkiv region has really accelerated. So the rate at which the Ukrainian military crumbles has accelerated, and it's a question of how long they can hold out before it becomes a rout. The Russians are in no hurry at all. The Ukrainians have been feeding in plentiful cannon fodder, losing up to 2,000 or around 2,000 people a day. Very unfortunate, but you know, the Russians can deal with that. And most of those casualties now are from air bombardment, not from any kind of direct engagement. And most of them die before they actually make it to the line of contact. They die on the way there. So that's basically what's going on.
When you look at the policy of NATO right now in Ukraine, if they have decided to help Ukrainians to do that, in your opinion, what's in their mind, why they're doing this right now, and what would be the outcome for NATO or even for Ukrainians? Because it doesn't seem to have anything positive when it comes to the battleground.
Well, you know, forget NATO. NATO is just a U.S. puppet. They do what the U.S. tells it to do. Forget the U.S. It's a collapsed, bankrupt regime that can't stop gorging itself on printed money that it sends through its military industrial contractors. So the money that it quote unquote gives to the Ukrainians is actually money that all of these crooks within the U.S. government and the defense industry in the United States pocket. And they have to keep doing this, because if they stopped, then it would turn out that all of these military contractors in the United States, well, not all of them, they're at this point rather few of them, they would end up bankrupt because they have given up on actually serving the needs of defense. And they're all interested in shareholder value and executive compensation, things like that. So they're not really interested in building useful weapon systems. They're far more interested in keeping the money flowing. And so the Ukraine has been and continues to be a way for these American crooks to continue pocketing lots and lots of freshly printed money. And that's really all that's going on. There's really no there's no strategy behind it. Everybody understands that the Ukraine has lost, that it has been defeated. In fact, it has been defeated more than a year ago. Anybody looking at the situation a year ago or a year and a half ago could have come to the conclusion that this is over, except for really useless activity. Now, the fact is that the Russians don't mind the fact that this is dragging on. They're doing rather well with it. They're building new weapon systems. They have a huge area in which they can test new electronic warfare systems, new drone aircraft technology, all of this new hardware that they're going to use themselves and sell to their friends and give to people who don't like the West, possibly free of charge. And that's going to change the picture around the world for the better as far as Russia is concerned, also as far as other countries such as China. And so the Ukraine is extremely useful as far as that goes. Also, the Ukraine provides the rationale for continued anti-Russian sanctions, which are a blessing for Russia because it gives Russia the impetus and the excuse to pursue a strategy of import replacement, which is quite successful. And it's already quite successful, but it has yet to run its course. For instance, there is still a lot of software that needs to be replaced with Russian-made software. And that process is ongoing, so we need those sanctions in place. And to make sure that those sanctions aren't lifted before everybody is ready, the warfare should continue. And so the Russians will continue doing it. There's also the social element in it, which is that the military action in the Ukraine has solidified Russian population, has made it remember its heroic roots, has made people much more patriotic. And if you look at the humanitarian action right now going on in the Kursk region, over the past few days, over 1,000 tons of humanitarian assistance have poured into that region from all of the surrounding regions. And a lot of that was done on a volunteer basis. A lot of the people who have been displaced by the incursion have been finding homes, basically people throwing their doors open to them all over Russia. So this is a really positive thing from a social point of view in Russia. The Russians are no longer selfish and interested in making as much money as possible and stockpiling consumer goods and racking up consumer credit and things like that. They have far more important things on their mind now, thanks to the special military operation. So it's generally a win for Russia.
And how about the European Union right now? We've learned that Shoigu was talking about sending weapons to Serbia. We had large protests in Serbia against BlackRock and some companies. And what's the policy of Russia toward Serbia, which is a country that Russia doesn't consider as enemy?
Well, Serbia is a longtime friend. Unfortunately, it is landlocked due to the loss of Montenegro. It is dependent on the European Union and has to play this weird game where it sort of pretends to want to become part of the European Union, but it's not going to be accepted because there's massive anti-Serbian discrimination within the European Union, which started with the bombing of Belgrade way back when. So the Serbians, they either don't understand or they don't want to understand that as far as the Europeans are concerned, they're proxies for Russia. They're just sort of like weak Russians that the Europeans can beat up to their heart's content. That's what they did during the conflict in Yugoslavia, and that they're going to continue doing it. Their president, Vucic, is sort of, I wouldn't call him two-faced, but he's kind of caught between a rock and a hard place. He has to find common ground with the European Union. At the same time, he has to deal with the fact that the vast majority of the Serbian population considers Russia their friend and wants to be close to Russia and is not particularly interested in close ties with the European Union and other European countries, especially those that are hostile to Russia. So it's a very confused situation there. It'll continue that way. It'll remain that way for the foreseeable future. There's no easy way out. There's no easy solution for Serbia at all. As far as Serbia receiving weapons from Russia, well, you know, that's great. Being armed is a way to be taken a little bit more seriously. And I hope that Serbia succeeds in being taken a little bit more seriously than it currently is.
It seems that Russia is already thinking of how to confront the United States in all of these regions, in Europe, in Africa, in the Middle East. And do you think that they're getting to the point that in the future there is no possibility to have a better relationship with the United States? That's why we have to talk with other countries, other players, important players, regional players.
Well, I think that the reason that the Russians took this path towards what you might consider all-out conflict with the U.S. and with NATO, which is basically a U.S. adjunct or add-on, is that the United States has collapsed. It hasn't had a real president for how long? I mean, do you think Biden is really the president of the United States? Come on, his brain doesn't work. And he's about to be replaced with somebody whose brain doesn't work either. You know, Kamala Harris is a complete joke. And everybody who doesn't have anything better to do just pokes fun at her. Nobody is ever going to really vote for her. The whole election in the United States is a joke. If you look at NATO and the United States as an armed entity, it is also a joke. It can't make weapons anymore, and the weapons that it makes are obsolete. Look at the planes that they gave, the F-16s that they gave to the Ukraine. They're basically 50-year-old planes that have been written off, and half of them are what are called organ donors. They're being stripped for spare parts to make other planes briefly fly, and they can't even use them for anything. Look at the aircraft carrier fleet. You know, they're putting an aircraft carrier somewhere close to Palestine because they expect that something might happen there. But the fact is that aircraft carriers these days, U.S. aircraft carriers, cannot fly sorties to any landmass that is equipped with modern rocketry, because without refueling, it's basically for each plane, it's the round trip is about 600 miles, and 300 miles is about the reach of a modern rocket. So they have to be 300 miles offshore, nautical miles offshore, or they have to do mid-air refueling, and mid-air refueling in a battle zone where your refueling aircraft could get shot down. You know, that's silly too. So the United States is no longer a military power. You have to keep that in mind. And that is why Russia is not at all concerned about NATO interference. What NATO can do now is join Ukrainian terrorists. NATO is now a terrorist organization. It is capable of minor mischief, and it'll be punished for that mischief. And that is all we can expect. The United States is afraid, deathly afraid, of stirring up any kind of direct military confrontation with Russia. That will be avoided at all costs. In fact, anytime there's any danger of that, the phones in Moscow start ringing from the Pentagon saying, please, 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 don't touch us, because, you know, we can't deal with it. We're soft skull patients at this point. We don't have anything. So please forgive us, and please understand that we have to make this mouth music to make ourselves look powerful, or we'll get fired. Have mercy on us. That's really the American stance at this point.
And right now, Mahmoud Abbas is in Russia. In your opinion, what's the political game for Russia in order to invite him? Because he's not that much popular in among Palestinians. But at the end of the day, what Russia tries to do in order to help Gazans, to help what's going on in that region?
Well, what Russia does to Gaza is fly 1,000 tons of humanitarian aid and tries to get that into Gaza itself. It tries to provide medical treatment to the Gazans. It does many, many things that are humanitarian things, and that is the most important thing. The deplorable loss of life in Palestine, and especially in the Gaza Strip, is something that the Russians want to do something about. It doesn't matter whether Mahmoud Abbas is popular or not. He still represents that society, whether anybody likes it or not, whether anybody thinks that, you know, he might be a little bit corrupt and not very effective, etc. That doesn't matter. And so he's still the face of the region as far as Russia is concerned, and he's still someone to coordinate humanitarian missions with. That's the reason he's in Moscow.
And how did you find the European Union, especially Germany, when it comes to this conflict right now in Kursk region between Russia? And because they were talking about German tanks against on Russian soil. And are they benefiting from this conflict, Germans?
No, they're not. I listened to some of the nonsense they were spouting. Like there's this character by the name of Julian Röpke, who's a giant Russophobe, and he was mouthing off about this conflict. And, you know, the funny thing is that this is a NATO mission. The invasion of Kursk is a NATO mission. It's a terrorist NATO mission. NATO people were involved in the planning. NATO people are involved in the communications. The Starlink system that the Ukrainians use, for instance, was provided by the US. So they knew everything about it ahead of time, except that they lied and pretended that they were taken by surprise. Their initial reaction was, we don't know what's going on, we're going to be finding out. So it's all just lies and posturing and nonsense. The logic that supposedly went through their heads, and Putin said that he thinks that that's what they thought, that's what these idiots thought, is that they would improve the Ukraine's quote unquote negotiating stance vis-a-vis Russia, thanks to this operation. So yes, a terrorist attack on Russia makes you a better negotiator. That's a bit of a stretch, isn't it? That didn't happen. So the gambit of, we'll march into the Kursk region, we'll grab a big chunk of it, and we'll use that chunk of land that we'll just squat on to negotiate with Moscow over some other chunk of land. That is just so ridiculous. That is just so pathetic. And of course, the Russians shot that out of the air before it got anywhere. You know, basically there will be no negotiations, and there's no Ukraine to negotiate with. Ukraine no longer has a president, it no longer has a parliament, it is no longer a federal state, as far as Russia is concerned. There may be still somebody to negotiate terms of surrender, because it doesn't matter who signs the terms of surrender. You could pull somebody off the street and make them sign it. It would be their first and last official act, and they would go into history that way. And that's completely different from a peace agreement. And the fact is, there's nobody in the Ukraine to sign a peace agreement whose signature would be adequate. And there's nobody outside of Ukraine who could sign on the Ukraine's behalf, because the Ukraine is supposedly a sovereign entity. So you can't say, well, we'll sign a peace agreement. We, the United States, for instance, or the European Union, or whoever, will sign a peace agreement on behalf of the sovereign entity. That doesn't work either. So there's no possibility of any peace agreement, none. And furthermore, why would Russia want a peace agreement when it can just continue this campaign until Ukrainian society internally revolts and reforms itself and purges itself of all the people who got it into this mess, this horrendous mess? And so the Russians are very interested in simply biding their time and not rushing things at all.
Right now in Russia, in your opinion, who's winning in terms of what would be the policy of how to respond to this attack? Because it's so important right now how Russia is thinking, how Russia is managing this situation in order to have a response to what has happened in that region. Do you think they're going to go after a military operation? They're going to do the same thing that they've been doing, just slowly going and without having much of casualties on the part of Russians? Is this operation in the Kursk region, which is so important, attack on civilians, and would bring some sort of emotions to Russians to go after some sort of drastic measures toward Ukraine? Is that possible?
Well, no. First of all, it's not the Ukraine. It's the United States. That's the enemy. Secondly, there's no point in going against the United States. The United States is very well collapsing on its own. So just by waiting, Russia will win. And really, we're one big financial fiasco, one giant crash away from the United States pretty much disappearing and going home and licking its wounds. We may even have a really nice result with the next presidential election, where there'll be a bit of a civil war and there just won't be time to devote to issues like the Ukraine. So there's really no reason to escalate. That would be like treating a nasty case of athlete's foot using sticks of dynamite. You know, it just makes no sense at all. And so what the Russians are doing in Kursk is killing all of the Ukrainians, all of the Ukrainian troops, killing them, and making sure that no new Ukrainian troops manage to penetrate the border. One and two. So that those are the orders. Nobody is questioning or disputing those orders. Nobody is suggesting anything else. Those are orders. And in Russia, orders are not discussed. That is really something that people around the world need to understand. Russians do not discuss their orders. They just execute them.
Yeah. And the other thing would be the objectives of the Ukrainian. You're talking about that the main reason that Ukrainians were doing this was behind the scene. NATO was planning everything and letting them to execute that plan. But what's in it for Ukraine right now? If just grabbing a piece of land, how would that benefit Ukraine, in your opinion? I'm not talking about NATO, the United States, and I'm talking about Ukrainian army. How they're getting killed right now, and why they're so convinced to do that?
Well, look, the Ukrainian army is getting killed at the rate of around 2,000 people a day. And on top of that, about 200 people a day are being killed in the south of Kursk region. So instead of 2,000 dead Ukrainians a day, you have 2,200 dead Ukrainians a day. Is that a big difference? You know, that does that change the picture appreciably? The fact is, the Russians are stepping up their game. So if you just, without Kursk, if you just waited another month, the Ukrainians would be dying at the rate of maybe 22,000 a day, maybe 25,000 a day. Who knows? A lot of them are dying from these huge Soviet era air bombs, air bombardment. You know, these old Soviet bombs that exist in gigantic stockpiles have been fitted with little stubby wings and a precision guidance system, so that they can fly in through a window if so programmed. Well, I'm exaggerating slightly, but they destroy everything within a radius of maybe 200 meters, and they have an air in targeting of maybe 20 meters. So this is huge destructive potential, and any grouping of armor or of personnel just basically gets wiped out. Entire munition dumps get wiped out. So the only thing that the Ukrainians can do is sort of be very diffuse across the landscape and pose a minor threat, because they can maintain small weapons fire or machine gun fire and maybe some mortars, and just generally be annoying. And since the Russians are very conservative in terms of trying not to get hurt, they'll just wait them out, really, and call in artillery and do everything they can to make sure that the Ukrainians are dead before the Russians advance. And so the question is, how long can the Ukrainians keep feeding the system of murder, basically murdering their own population by throwing it at Russia? And that's not going very well. So the recruiters who are scouring the landscape looking for new army recruits, their cars are getting torched. It's getting to a point where they get physically attacked. There was a case where recruiters were attacked by a man with a knife. And that's going to spread. They're the most hated people in all of Ukraine now. And at some point, it'll be decided that they're not very useful, and they'll get sent to the front. That'll be an interesting end game. All the recruiters go to the front and die. And then what do you do? Well, nothing. So really, it's a battle. The Ukrainians have been very heavily brainwashed. It's going to take a long time for them to come around to the realization that the Americans have duped them to such a ridiculous extent. The Ukrainians have been duped more than any other country in the world has ever been duped. They no longer have a country. In terms of demographics, the Ukrainian nation is dead. It will never get its population back. It's basically, it sold its own country, its own land to companies like BlackRock. It's finished. So all of those realizations have to come home, and they have to stop fighting, and they have to actually want and demand and clamor for peace before the Russians will even consider any sort of a limited ceasefire. They have to basically reform themselves and make themselves worthy before the Russians will consider any sort of a peace gesture.
Dmitry, just to wrap up this session, one of the main questions that everybody has in his mind, his or her mind, is when these analysts all around the world, they're talking about Russia. Mostly they're confusing Russia with Soviet Union. We know that Russia has a lot in terms of what's going on internally. Military industrial complex has its roots in Soviet Union. But at the end of the day, the policy of Russia in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union, since Putin took power in Russia, is totally different. It's not anything similar to what it was in my mind. And right now, how do you, if you were to draw the differences between Russia and Soviet Union, and the way I'm talking about I'm not talking about domestic policies, I'm talking about the international policies, the way that they're witnessing all the regions all around the world. There are some regions, for example, Africa, that Soviet Union tried to help them, and Russia right now is there. But I'm talking about those differences that you are witnessing right now between Russia today and Soviet Union.
Well, I think that there are great similarities because the Soviet Union, in terms of its composition, was pretty much Russia plus some neighboring lands. And there's a lot of the reason why those neighboring lands were there was to create a buffer zone to keep invaders out. And that isn't necessary anymore. It's no longer a part of military strategy to create giant buffer zones. There are other security strategies that are far more effective. In terms of Russia's role in the world, Russia as the Soviet Union or Russia as the Russian Federation, is somewhat similar because it's an industrial powerhouse. In the Soviet days, about a third of all the electric generating capacity in the world was built in the Soviet Union. They have built huge projects all over the world, not just roads and railroads and bridges, but huge hydroelectric dams in countries such as Egypt. And many, many other projects. Wherever the Russians went, they built schools, hospitals, etc. The Soviet Union was also very active in having countries around the world liberate themselves from Western colonialism. That is the role that Russia played in Africa. And all of these African nations are still grateful. They haven't forgotten. They know who granted them their sovereignty. And of course, after the Soviet Union collapsed, there was a period of weakness where they didn't have this powerful protector from the North. And the neo-imperialists with their financial swindles poured in and robbed a lot of countries. And that is now being remedied. So now Russia is participating in decolonization round two, you could say, especially in the Sahel right now in Africa, but also in other countries. And so there's a continuity in Russian history from the Russian Empire to the Soviet Union to the Russian Federation. And a lot of people who have had dealings with Russia all along have a long memory, unlike a lot of people in the West who can't even remember World War II anymore and are celebrating Nazis as they are now in Germany. And you know, like the poor, wretched people of Japan who can't remember who dropped nuclear bombs on them. That's just, if it wasn't sad, it would be funny. But people around the world do remember and do have a sense of gratitude. So a lot of Russia's success, diplomatic success around the planet now, especially with what is now being called the Global South, even though it's not necessarily particularly Southern, It has to do with this sense of gratitude, this deep-seated sense of gratitude towards Russia, be it the Soviet Union, be it the Russian Federation, be it the Russian Empire.
Thank you so much for being with us, Dmitry. Great pleasure, as always.
Thank you.